How do everybody? It's Remember the 5th of November, and it's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, coming to you from just outside Liverpool, and in Glasgow, that's Glasgow, not Edinburgh, as usual, is site designer, editor, and all-round overlord Scott Morris.
How do?
And in Brighton's and Falkirk is site contributor Drew Tavendale.
How do?
Tonight we're going to be looking at Clive Barker's Midnight Meat Train, Quantum of Solace, and John Woo's Red Cliff. So without further ado, we're going to rattle on and do that thing. Clive Barker isn't normally a name synonymous with high-quality horror, least of all in the cinematic idiom. Fans of the intellectually and linguistically retarded Crassmonger will no doubt delight in the Midnight Meat Train's continuation of this exquisitely lambastable tradition. Centred on the misadventures of a street photographer whose focus is the seedy underbelly of New York's nightlife, the Midnight Meat Train thunders unstoppably through a network of seemingly endless, infinitely pointless plot tunnels, running the red lights of common sense and literary aptitude with gay abandon. As the hero of the story, Leon Kaufman, Bradley Cooper is as wet as a blanket hung out to dry in an Indonesian beach garden 2 Christmases ago. His commitment to his art is commendable in some sense, though sense itself seems firmly thin on the ground, as he pursues would-be rapists onto the NY subway system in pursuit of the ultimate documentarian snapshot, at the behest of a demanding and increasingly mannish Brooke Shields. Their flirtatious relationship soon falls by the wayside in favour of Leon's discovery of a character, known only by the label Mahogany, which adorns his travel bag, who seems to spend this time wantonly murdering commuters on the midnight train service. For the city that supposedly never sleeps, the night train seems rather conveniently devoid of custom, save for the odd individual or easily wrangled group of 2 or 3. But it affords Leon's investigations into Mahogany's activities a convenient plot isolation that a writer of Barker's calibre could not otherwise hope to explain. Needless to say, things all start to go a bit Pete Tong, with Leon eventually confronted by Mahogany, and his relationship with his supportive partner Maya, played by Leslie Bibb, put at increasing strain, reaching its nadir in a climax that, in a style typical of Barker's inability to offer anything approaching real horror, plays out like a cross between Kill Bill and The Terminator by way of a trauma movie. Japanese director Ryuhei Kitamura came to some recognition on the international stage with 2000's cult hit Versus, and he does here make at least some attempt at expanding his scope with some early scenes that almost offer some sense of foreboding and a detached, dreamlike style of camera work that momentarily evokes an appropriate atmosphere. He is, however, ultimately undermined by the material, which is, in true Barker fashion, a fetid pile of steaming horse cack, resolving itself in the immature fashion we've come to expect from a social spastic whose only fascination in life is stabbing people through the head. I will admit to having been initially quite pleasantly surprised by Midnight Meat Train guys, but as far as I'm concerned, it degenerates into a debacle faster than you can click your fingers. Scott, you enjoyed it, did you not?
Well, I think you've made 2 crucial mistakes here. Firstly, you expected a plot. I cannot think why you did this. Certainly, I'm not sure why you're blaming Clive Barker so much. I mean, this is adapted from his short story, which I think was about 4 or 5 pages. If memory serves, it's essentially a completely original work that has a Clive Barker name stamped on it for some reason. So you can't perhaps blame him for all of the excesses here.
I'm going to go and sit in the corner now.
It is not in any way, shape or form a good film. What it is a lot of fun, I thought at least. What else can you say about a film where Vinnie Jones hammers out Ted Raimi's eyes? Now, I could say a lot of other things about the film, but it has Vinnie Jones hammering out Ted Raimi's eyes. You can come up with a lot of arguments as to why this isn't a good film. I would always respond with, it has Vinnie Jones hammering out Ted Raimi's eyes. Is there any way that that is not a good thing in any film, even if Ted Raimi's not in it?
Even for myself, that was almost a saving grace. I'll grant you that.
I mean, the only other thing I can really say about it is that it is an unabashed slasher film of the sort we've not really seen a lot of lately. A lot of the slasher films we've suffered through in the last 15... seems like 15 years, perhaps 5 is more appropriate, but they've all been trying to cater towards a 15 rating. So you'll have slasher films where you don't actually see any blood. It will cut away from the cutting, if you'll pardon the term. This, at least, is a sort of lowbrow, very silly, just hacking people up film. For at least that's the parts that I found that were sort of relatively fun. At least it's interesting to see that sort of thing. This kind of sort of nasty brutality has been reserved lately for stuff like Saw and Hostel, where it's the objection I have to those sort of films is it's always trying to put some sort of level of irony or social responsibility or something onto it by trying to make it clever in some way, which is just not really what you want from this sort of film. This, at least, is just big and bloody and silly. Now, there are points. I mean, pretty much anything that isn't someone getting butchered is filler. Pretty much any plot that has your Leon going through his daily life is just padding. and has no interest to anyone whatsoever. I can't put my hand on my heart and tell you this is a good film. It's at least interesting, and I found that it was fun for in a incredibly lowbrow sort of slightly ashamed of being of sitting there giggling at it. But I relatively enjoyed it for what it's worth.
That's absolutely nuts. Drew, which side of this fence do you fall on?
I'm more towards your side of the fence. You know, the one that clearly sees that it's rubbish. Ted Raimi's flying eyeballs aside. It's like the rather sedate pacing at the beginning. It started off reasonably competently, and I was prepared to get into it. But then after about half an hour, I just lost all interest. And by the end, I was pretty much having to force myself to watch it. It's not very interesting. It's not very good. There's no plot. And I was actually rather disappointed because I thought the concept of some sort of conspiracy to butcher people on New York subways might have actually been more effective and more enjoyable had it been something of a serial killer film rather than adding in the silly supernatural nonsense at the end.
Well, that's what I objected most to, yeah.
Which is only really hinted at once, perhaps twice, during the rest of the film. And it just didn't work for me at all. It needed to be...
I think better is the word you're looking for, isn't it?
Yes. It very much needed to be better. I just think it played it wrong. If it had gone for being a serial killer film, I think that would have actually been scarier.
Yeah, scary, it would certainly be something to be afraid of.
Yeah, so the idea that there might be some sort of conspiracy to kill people and it was just a serial killer, and that's feel more brutal. Then you add the supernatural element. How tawdry.
Yeah, exactly, as you say it. At the point at which it introduces a supernatural element, you say, well, there you go, I've got nothing to be worried about then, have I, really? There's nothing to play on my mind if it's to do with satanic hellspawn running about, which, well, sure isn't going to ruin it for anybody. But it annoyed most in that, I mean, Clive output based on Clive Barker material, I've never understood people's fascination with Hellraiser. I've always thought it was that was an absolutely ridiculous piece of shit. Material based on Clive Barker's output is almost always without any reserve terrible. And as this movie began, I thought, oh, hang on, there are a couple of moments where it seems to establish a vaguely unique visual style, and it does come across with some sort of strange, I think I mentioned, dreamlike atmosphere, or sort of very manages to convey a strange sense of foreboding in the first maybe 5-10 minutes, and it takes a couple of possibly intriguing concepts and then flushes them down the toilet in favour of some stupid, you know. Oh, well, I can't say too much without giving anything away, as much as there is to give away, but it was a shame to have, you know, some sliver of hope implanted and then cruelly snatched away.
Yeah. On the upside, though, they did decide to have Vinnie Jones and not have him speak, which is to be applauded.
Yes, it is. It is. Until the very end, you can forgive him that. It's in a very swordfish kind of manner in that respect, isn't it? I think he gets one line in the whole film, in both of them. Vinnie Jones, some might say, better seen than heard. I would just say, better not seen, better not heard. Maybe that's just me. Midnight Meat Train has had a limited release this Halloween, so you might be unlucky enough to catch up with it. I don't know. Scott, this week you watched John Woo's latest film, Red Cliff, did you not? What's that all about?
I think you probably have to argue that John Woo's been the most successful Asian director to fall over to Hollywood and actually attempt to do some halfway decent works. His only really bad film so far has been Paycheck, but I'm thankful to see that he's actually gone back to Asia. He's not going back to his heroic bloodshed films, though. He's doing a historical epic based on The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, at least loosely. It is released in Asia in two parts, I believe. When it finally shows up over here, it will get cut down to 1 2.5-hour film from the 4-hour Asian release it's likely to be. That is kind of the problem with it, so we'll get back to that in a moment. The rough plot of it, and I'm not going to go into this in much detail because, well, I'm not Wikipedia. It is a time of vast civil war. Around about 220 AD, the Han dynasty fragments into three power bases. The young Han emperor has basically been manipulated and ruled over by his prime minister, Cao Cao. And we're told he's a greedy and ambitious man, and of no real reason to doubt it. In the west, the land is being ruled by a noble lord, Sun Quan, and his army led by equally noble and fearsome generals. While they're busy protecting their people from Cao Cao's and invading massive armies, they're also taking heavy losses by doing so. They realise the only way they'll be able to fend off the evil that assaults them is to seek an alliance with a warlord from the south, Liu Bei, and his general and the resident tactical genius Zhu Yu, who here is played by Tony Leung. Without this alliance, and it's of course likely that Cao Cao, if he does steamroller the guys from the west, will just plough on down to the south, and the only way they can hope to defeat the massive army that Cao Cao has got together is by teaming up and fighting him on directly. Now, that sounds like an awful lot of setup, and it is. And if there is any flaw in this film, it's the fact that this film is pretty much 2 hours of setup for that continues to promise that there's going to be a really massive battle, and it shows you really massive armies massing, and it builds up a lot of tension towards what's going to be a massive, epic showdown. And then the film ends and says, come back in a couple of months, we'll see the remainder of it. And this is somewhat annoying. In fact, it's really, really annoying. In fact, it's bloody irritating. It shows at least that the film is working. It has made me, I've been chomping at the bit to see how this is actually going to wind up. And it's not also fair to say that it's not completely without its action. There's several what will hopefully be seen as skirmishes by the time the whole thing is over that are very well done. It is epic in scope. It has that sort of Lord of the Rings-esque, fairly large army sort of massing and fighting each other. I would somewhat doubt how historically accurate it is. It seems that actually having an army is something of an afterthought, because if you have about 3 or 4 generals, they're so incredibly skilled warriors they can plough through hundreds upon hundreds of other people as though they're playing Dynasty Warriors on the Xbox or something. However, that aside, I can't really find too much fault with it. There's enough action sort of peppered throughout through various little skirmishes to keep you interested in what's going on, while it does build up a number of fairly compelling characters. It's a very solid base to go forward on. It has something of the feel of, say, Fellowship of the Rings to it. It's really just producing a very solid base from which to do something, hopefully, spectacular in the next film. It's a very pretty film, very visually impressive. It has one of the best uses of CG that I've seen of late, in as much as it's not trying to wow you with sort of one big silly CG monster. Instead, it's used for one thing where CG still has a powerful advantage, and that's just in scale. It can show you, it can have a camera panning back and showing you like thousands upon thousands of Navy ships approaching down the Yangtze. It's very solidly acted. I've skipped over most of the actor names because I probably can't pronounce them very well. However, pretty much anyone who's then working in Asia at the moment is probably going to feature in this film in some capacity. It's epic in scope and scale. It is very highly recommended. Now, whether or not you bother tracking down the half of the film that is currently available from Asia on DVD, I would probably hold fire at least until you can watch them both one after the other, or perhaps wait for it to get a cinema release where, as I say, it's going to be condensed into one film. I don't know how well that will condense into one film. It's a fairly dense work already. However, we can but see, but certainly it's worth a look, if not now, in the future when the other half's available.
Fair dinkum.
It's disappointing that not all of it's available, and I think I certainly would prefer to wait now, because I'm not the most patient of people. That would just irritate me, not being able to find out how the story continued.
What I would prefer as a Westerner is not to have to take the cut down sort of 2-in-1 version, but rather have access at some point to both halves on DVD. Presumably it's not going to get a cinema release at all over here in the two separate films. Hopefully we'll have access to both on DVD though, once it hits the shops, once it hits retail, and probably rather check it out that way than have to watch a sort of a massively cut down version in the cinema. It's been 2 years since the excellent Daniel Craig leapt into the shoes of James Bond for the Casino Royale reboot, throttling out of the franchise the humour, compassion and gadgets of previous incarnations in favour of a Bond more true to Fleming's novels. The seemingly improbably titled Quantum of Solace takes its name from a Bond short story, though the action instead picks up immediately where the last film left off, with Bond transporting a captive Mr. White in the boot of a soon-to-be-perforated Aston Martin. Viewed as a middle section under the assumption of a trilogy, Quantum is, on paper, little more than a bridge section between Casino's A and the expected resolution at point B of a third installment. It does little more than offer a string of breathless set pieces as Bond gathers intel on a mysterious organisation, Quantum, of whom Britain's Secret Service know nothing, who in addition to formulating a plot to control a valuable natural resource, also appear to be behind the death of Bond's love Vesper. It is of course the latter with which Jimmy is most concerned, though the former affords him the perfect ruse under which to off a string of those responsible for cessating his strumpet. Quantum is a briskly paced beast, Swiss director Mark Foster, most recently of the Kite Runner fame, having the good sense to keep the audience in anticipation of the next anxious fistfight, though some have lamented the new Bond's relentless nihilism and lack of gadgetry. These people, calling themselves Bond fans, would no doubt refuse to accept they are in fact Bond film fans, as anyone who has read a Fleming novel will tell you that Bond is, in truth, a selfish, callous bastard who bears as much resemblance to Roger Moore's incarnation as Mother Teresa did to Hitler. Daniel Craig is James Bond, and Quantum of Solace is an unstoppable juggernaut that, whilst flawed, serves its purpose clinically In much the same fashion, the real James approaches his own work. It's the shortest Bond film to date, and a better dose of entertainment I defy you to find this side of 100 minutes. Bro stuff, in my opinion. I can understand why some people have viewed this fairly negatively. It's not heavy on... Well, ironically, some people have claimed that it is maybe too heavy on plot, whereas I thought it was a little too light on plot, but it serves its purpose in my book. Drew, would you did you enjoy Quantum of Solace?
It was all right, but compared to Casino Royale, certainly not a patch in it, and I was really rather disappointed. Although it did put me against it within a few minutes with one of my pet hates of constant choppy editing, where apparently he was allergic to the thought of the same camera angle being on screen for more than 24 frames, because apparently that helps add kinetic energy, as opposed to just being really, really irritating, not allowing people to see what's going on. Other than that, yeah, I'm not quite sure where these people saying it's too heavy in plot are getting off, because it's, like you say, it's too light in plot.
I think they're having difficulty keeping up with the exposition, because, as you say, it's so brief and so choppily edited and so relentless in its pace that it doesn't actually give you time to digest what's happening in some scenes.
Yeah, it's not even so much can't digest, it's just irritated, because the choppy editing even continues when Bond and M are having a normal conversation inside a flat where nobody's moving about at all, and the same editing technique still being used. It's pretty much had me screaming internally, stop fucking editing.
Not quite as bad in the conversational scenes as the fight scenes, but...
Well, no, but the fact that it's still there at all is just silly and irritated me. Somebody's been watching too many Tony Scott films, I think. And I've totally lost my train of thought. Where was I? Choppy editing.
going down your notepad now. Plot, convolution, sloppy editing. No shagging. All right, well, we can catch up with your thought train at another platform. Scott,
thank you.
Scott, what was your take on Quantum of Solace?
I did enjoy it when I was sat there throughout it. I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I might. The actions, as Drew said, the editing is just somewhat irritating, and it brought me out of it a little bit. And when you strip the action out of a Bond film, then it stops really being quite so compelling. I suppose, like, we'll get the positives out of the way thing first. What you've done in this film is not so much with the plot, but I think in terms of character development, it's better. Or maybe not character development so much, but from here on in, you now have a fairly solid idea of why Bond would become such a womanizing nightmare that became in the films, if that's the way they decide to go with it. They've set it up in such a way that it can explain certain traits that Bond may well go on to have, and I think it does that quite well. I think it shows how that he's probably not going to form any particular close attachments to anyone from here on in.
Yeah.
It's not really compatible with his line of work, and he's learned that fairly harshly. It's, in that kind of terms, it has made Bond a more interesting character than he's been probably ever. In terms of the rest of it, the rest of the film itself, it's fine that it's there, but it's very much Casino Royale 1.5. It's not particularly great. Now, if I'm going to start going into complaining about it, you know, I'm not really complaining about the film as much as I'm complaining about the direction that it's taking. Things like, well, basically we've come back to the whole issue of rebooting it in the first place. I mean, you have a Bond film franchise, and let's not talk about the books for a minute here. We're talking about a Bond film franchise, which is, I would say, it must be the most successful franchise in the history of film.
Yeah, it is.
How much do you want to change that? 22 films over 46 years? Now, how much do you want or need to change that? Now, I like the Bourne identity and the rest of the films as much as anyone else. However, if I want to see them, I've got them sitting on the shelf. I'm not adverse to seeing more of this sort of thing, but Is it now time to start bringing in elements of the Bond films that made the Bond films so successful, which you would think may be a good idea, what with them being so successful and all? That said, I can't really argue with the box office that Quantum of Solace has taken so far. Now, bit of a toss-up as where you want to go with this, really. Do you want to start bringing in things like the gadgets, not to the sort of silly excesses of having invisible cars or hover gondolas or anything like that, but do you want to start bringing in some sort of relatively normal gadgets back into it? Do you want to start bringing in some slightly more charismatic villains into it? I mean, Bond villains have always been fairly iconic. Things like Christopher Walken having it up as Max Zorin or Blofeld or anyone like that. Whereas in this film, you've got Dominic Green, who is essentially a middle manager.
Yeah, he's a businessman, isn't he?
Isn't that the point, though? That's a bit more believable than someone like a guy who floats about in a blimp trying to blow up a fault line and cause an earthquake.
Again, and how much do you want to go with realism? Has Bond films ever been about realism? Do you want to start just doing the books?
Yeah, but the point is, though, that they've stated we want to reboot the franchise, we want to get away from the old stuff, and I'm glad that's what they're doing. I can understand, though, that in you kind of have to meet the material halfway, and in the case of Quantum of Solace, they've perhaps gone too far towards the Bond of the literature, which I, as someone who has enjoyed, I mean, I haven't read all the Bond books, I've read two or three of them. I enjoy that side of it because I'm becoming more of a narcissistic bastard as I go on in life, and I identify more with that Bond. I admire his moral flexibility, shall we say, but I can understand why that doesn't make for the most entertaining 100 minutes of cinema for a lot of people who want to go and see a Bond film. But at the same time, they've stated that's what they want to do. They want to go back to more to the roots of Bond and have a more compelling Bond. I'm glad they've gone away from the gadgets, but like you, I think if they want to bring them back in, that's fine. They were in the books, but they weren't things like invisible fucking cars. They were things like, well, the problem they have though now is that everybody's got a micro camera built into their mobile phone these days. A lot of the stuff that seemed like fantastical gadgets back in the 60s and 70s, you know, gyrocopters in a suitcase aside, are actually reasonably accessible to most people these days. So what do you do with sort of fantastical gadgets?
Yeah, but there's a thing too. I mean, he is a spy. Although, obviously, the world's least successful one, because every person he ever meets already knows who he is.
Well, in the old films, imagine, they certainly do, but not in this one.
You would imagine, though, that a spy would need to have some sort of technology to carry out his job to the best of his ability. So there's got to be some space for them. And, you know, silly, we're going to remove all gadgets, but we're going to have a really silly touchscreen desk and a big clear wall with all the images on instead of just a computer screen.
I was going to say, that's clearly what Q Division's been doing for the last couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah. We're going to go all Minority Report for a minute and chuck stuff about in a virtual desk.
Yeah, clearly when I get my patio doors replaced, it will be with a big TV screen patio door instead. It's obviously exactly the way things are going.
The only thing missing from that scene was a classical musical in the background, wasn't it? No, I'm quite pleased with the direction they've taken with this film. And as I say, were it intended as a trilogy, I think people would look back on this and say that in terms of installments, this serves its purpose admirably. But the stumbling block there is that there's some talk already that this isn't actually going to be a trilogy, and that Daniel Craig himself has said, as far as I'm aware, that's the last we've heard of Quantum for the meantime, which is going to leave a lot of people feeling a bit gypped, I think. And I would probably, although I myself am happy with the film, I can understand that entirely from another point of view. So
yeah, well, I suppose there's always the danger that Quantum becomes the next Spectre.
Exactly.
It's a bit silly, really, but the idea of it being sort of influential businessmen doing stuff actually makes a lot more sense than rather a group of terrorists who call themselves terrorists.
Yeah. I don't necessarily want to go back to the sort of caricature sort of individual villains of the old films. I mean, I enjoy the old films for what they are. However, once you get past, once you pretty much get past from Russia with Love, they do start to suffer from a sort of a snowballing effect of ludicrous plot lines, which culminate obviously in the Moore films. And anybody who thinks Moore was the best Bond is clearly a fucking retard.
Yeah, especially since Moore was very, very clearly the worst Bond. Man's terrible.
But he went into space.
Yeah.
I think the thing you'd have to watch with wanting somewhat more realistic villains is how many businessmen do you want Bond to face off over the next 20 years?
Yeah, it's not exactly going to fight an exciting foe, is it, even if it's more realistic?
I'd like to see him stab Vladimir Putin in the face. Well, maybe there's only so far you can take that material, and maybe we're not going to see another 20-odd Bond films, but I'd rather see two or three more of a more realistic bent than sort of bring too much back from the old films, because that's the whole point of this, and that's what I've been looking forward to, is the type of scene in this film where he stabs some fella in the leg and then sits there holding his pulse, waiting for it to cease sort of looking about in a bored fashion. You know, come on, hurry up and die, would you? That's the Bond I want. He's a miserable shit. More power to him.
Callous.
Well, there you go then. Mixed views on Bond. No doubt you'll probably end up seeing it anyway, so it doesn't matter what we say.
Would say it's not so much mixed reviews. I still think it's very well worth going to see. I think it's a very enjoyable film.
Okay, sorry.
It's there's interesting talks to be had about where Bond's going, but in terms of just being a halfway decent film to go and watch, then there's no question that you should really go and see Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, it's a good film. It's just not as good as I was hoping, or it could have been, or as good as Casino Royale. That's the disappointment for me. Not that it's not a good film in itself.
I think there's one particularly good reason to go and see it, and that's the strange squealing noise Matthew Almerick makes when he's swinging an axe at Bond near the end.
In the hotel composed entirely of bottles of hydrogen.
Yes, and strange melting plastic.
Who could have predicted?
Yes.
what would have happened there?
I think the way that...
What a shock that was.
The sort of foam ceiling tiles and stuff, and the way that building just sort of spontaneously starts to melt, I'm thinking someone should have been in here a few years ago looking for asbestos. It reminded me too much of the science corridor at our high school. Well, folks, thanks for listening once again. It's been an absolute pleasure. I, as always, have been Craig Eastman, and as always, up in Glasgow was Scott Morris.
Take it easy.
And in Falkirk, as always, was Drew Tavendale.
Goodbye.
We'll be back to... talk about some new releases again some juncture soon, but until then I'm going to go and finish my gin, and we'll speak to you then. Take care. Sorry, I just had gin come out my nose.